Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for July 9th, 2010.
The Science Update Podcast is produced by AAAS, advancing science, serving society.
The mouth opens and closes quickly as the head moves towards the recipient but doesn't make contact.
If you saw one living today, it would be reconstructed something like a rat or maybe a squirrel with a big bushy tail.
Sense of direction seems to be innate, not learned.
The feather shaft seemed to be very thin on both Archaeopteryx and Confucianus.
This week, researchers are deciphering ape gestures with surprising results. Paleontologists have unearthed fossils revealing the world's oldest bite marks, and neurobiologists think they may be born with a sense of direction already in place. But first, Suzanne Bard investigated a case of some very flimsy feathers.
What is the airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow?
What do you mean? An African or European swallow?
Long before Monty Python's infamous swallows ever evolved, winged creatures called Archaeopteryx and Confucianus took to the skies. Or did they? Paleontologists have long debated whether the first bird-like dinosaurs, which emerged 125 to 150 million years ago, could actually fly.
Some people said that these birds were capable of flight, and others had concluded the opposite, that they weren't capable of flapping flight.
That's evolutionary biologist Robert Nudds of the University of Manchester in England. Along with Gareth Dyke of University College Dublin, he took measurements of the fossilized feathers.
So he noticed that the feather shaft seemed to be very thin on both Archaeopteryx and Confucianus. You can see the feathers on some of the fossil specimens. We then took those measurements and used beam theory, which we borrowed from the field of engineering, to calculate how strong these feathers would be, so how much force they could withstand before the shaft would buckle or break.
Nudds says if their feathers were hollow like those of modern birds, they would have been too weak for flapping flight.
And from our calculations, we found that the feathers of Confucianus were 100 times weaker than we would expect for an existing bird with the same size wingspan or wing length. And Archaeopteryx was 10 times weaker than we would expect for an existing bird with a similar size wings and feathers.
But paleontologists haven't yet been able to determine whether their feathers were actually hollow.
If they're modeled as a solid rod, we find that they are actually capable of sustaining the forces required for flapping flight. So if we are going to say that these birds flew, then we have to assume that their feathers were structurally different to what we see in living birds, and that is that they were maybe a solid cross-section. There's not enough information from the fossils at the moment to determine whether they were solid or hollow. And until we know what the cross-section of the feathers are, I wouldn't like to say that they were incapable of any type of flight.
But he says even if the feathers were solid, the calculations show that their flight ability would still have been very weak compared to that of modern birds.
Listen, in order to maintain airspeed velocity, a swallow needs to beat its wings 43 times every second, right? Please! Am I right? I'm not interested!
Thanks, Suzanne. In other paleontology news, scientists have identified the oldest known bite marks from a mammal on dinosaur bones and others dating back 75 million years. Michael J. Ryan, curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History, says the biter had paired opposing teeth, seen only in mammals at the time. Most likely, it belonged to a group of rodent-like mammals called multituberculates.
If you saw one living today, it would be reconstructed something like a rat or maybe a squirrel with a big bushy tail. And we suspect, just like modern living rodents, they needed calcium sources, and they would look for sort of defleshed, exposed bone to actually gnaw on to get that calcium source.
He says the find offers a rare glimpse of the smaller, more fragile species that lived in the dinosaurs' shadows. Next, Justin Warner reports that scientists in Scotland have taken a step toward understanding the gestures used by orangutans.
Humans use lots of gestures to communicate, and so do apes. Now, researchers at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland have taken a crack at figuring out what orangutan gestures actually mean. Erica Cartmill and Richard Byrne studied orangutans in three different European zoos. They tracked dozens of gesture types and came up with translations for about 40 of them. Byrne says there wasn't a system in place for translating the gestures, so they had to invent one.
The heart of it is to look for the typical reaction of the audience that appears to satisfy the signaler.
In other words, they presume that the ape doing the gesture wants a very specific reaction, and if he gets it, he'll stop. If not, he'll keep trying until he does.
So where we had an interaction where one ape gestures, the other reacts, and that clearly makes the signaler happy. He stops gesturing and gets on with something else. Then we felt that we had got into the mind of the signaler and had some idea of what he was trying to achieve.
They combined these observations with an independent analysis of the gesture based on what they already knew about orangutans and their society. Some of the gestures had rather non-intuitive meanings.
I would not have guessed that the gesture called an air bite would be effective in eliciting the start of play or some kind of friendly contact. And the description of this gesture is that the mouth opens and closes quickly as the head moves towards the recipient but doesn't make contact. I don't think I'd have worked that out.
On the other hand, other gestures, like offering an object to a fellow orangutan, were very recognizable. Byrne says they probably seem familiar to us because we're apes too, and may share some of the same communicative instincts. Next, his team would like to figure out why orangutans have developed many different gestures, synonyms, if you will, for the same intention.
Thanks, Justin. The size of specific areas of the brain affect our personality, according to University of Minnesota researchers. For example, they found that extroverted, outgoing people have a larger medial orbitofrontal cortex. They also found brain structures whose size related to agreeableness, conscientiousness, and neuroticism. But they can't yet say whether the brain structures create the personality traits or if the personality traits affect the brain structures. In other psychology news, researchers report in the journal Science that our sense of touch can have a profound effect on how we make decisions and form opinions. For example, people who handled rough objects and then witnessed two people interacting were more likely to think the people were hostile. People who had handled smooth objects thought the people were friendly. Finally, scientists have puzzled for many years over whether we're born with an innate sense of direction or whether we have to learn to navigate through worldly experience. Suzanne says they're getting closer to an answer.
Researchers at University College London have discovered that newborn rats are just as good as adult rats at determining which direction they're facing. Cognitive neuroscientist Francesca Cacuce led the study.
Sense of direction seems to be innate, not learned. You don't need to explore an environment or explore your spatial surroundings in order to build a sense of where you're heading.
She says the brain processes underlying an understanding of spatial relationships are similar in rats and humans, and we may also be born with an innate sense of direction. In contrast, she says that developing a sense of how far apart things are is a bit more complicated and probably does take some interaction with the environment.
You really need to have walked a little bit before you get to know and understand what is the relationship between trees and houses and buildings and things in order to build this representation.
Thanks for that report, Suzanne. Well, that's all we have for you this week. Next week, we'll tell you how scientists are getting flamingos to breed in captivity by playing them love songs, and why some bees aren't quite as busy as you might think, along with other fascinating stories from the animal world. But if you can't wait that long, tune into the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. You can also check out Science Update's fan page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And if you have a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use your question, we'll send you a Science Update mug. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.